Tonight on Arena, Paula Meehan brings 25 years of writing together in her selected poems, and in his new book, A Sound Mind, Paul Morley ditches pop and rock for classical music. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. When in middle age, writer Paul Morley found himself retreating into the sounds of artists he had loved as an emerging music journalist writing for NME in the 1970s, he stopped himself. He didn't want to give in to nostalgia and went searching for something new. He found it in classical music. In his new book, A Sound Mind, Morley argues that this genre is the most exciting and rebellious in music, and just as rock and roll itself. And I'm delighted to have Paul Morley join me on the phone this evening. I just wonder, Paul, a man who has been steeped in pop and rock music and writing about pop and rock music for a long time, did it feel like a total volte-face? Did you feel you were abandoning everything when this classical music, this love of classical music, crept up on you?
Well, I think I must make it clear, first of all, that I definitely wasn't ditching pop and rock in a melodramatic fashion.
I thought you might say that.
I know that it's often desired to have an either-or scenario for the sake of argument. I think what was interesting to me was more developing of, a widening of musical kind of parameters. And obviously with streaming, I was able to access all forms of classical music that ever existed. And it got very exciting for me. And I guess it's a kind of dignity. I didn't want to carry on writing about pop music in my mid-50s. And suddenly this other world opened up. And as much as listening to it, it also gave me an opportunity to write about something new as if it was all new music.
And what's surprising is you had a couple of rubs up against classical music early on in your life, particularly in the year 1973 when you bought your first classical music album.
Yes, I bought a Music for Pleasure, Classics for Pleasure, Cheap Woolies version of Holst's The Planets. And it was almost the essence of what the difference was in my life between classical and pop music. Pop music was recorded so spectacularly, so splendidly. And this classical album, the sound of it was so tinny and puny, even though there was a huge orchestra on there. And I've learned to love it over time and appreciate its dynamics. Back then, it sounded very weedy next to the pop and rock that I was listening to. So it kind of put me off for quite a while, certainly that kind of formal classical tradition.
Well, let's try not to put you off and nobody else off, hopefully, at this time at 7:06 on a Monday evening. This is what you heard, or something like this that you heard in 1973 that meant very little to you. The opening section there of the first movement of The Planets from Gustav Holst's Mars, the Bringer of War, and that's in a recording featuring the London Symphony Orchestra, a piece which Paul Morley rejected outright in 1973, but things changed in the meantime. Of course, it doesn't help us, Paul, that it starts so quietly, and it takes it a while to get going, obviously. But what changed and how did it change over time?
Over time, and I mean, there was always the fringes of classical music where it met, if you like, the fringes of experimental rock that I was always interested in. Where the Can and the Brian Enos of the world were feeding off the Steve Rices and the minimalism. So I was always interested in instrumental music and certainly, quite avant-garde instrumental music. But I think what started to happen is that I got more and more curious about putting things in context. So that piece of music, when I heard it originally, would have been completely out of context. And I guess what I started to do, which became the book, was create my own history of classical music, where I could create a different kind of context for it from the one I was coming across in a more formal setting through the institutions, through the way it was usually written about. To some extent, I wanted to see if I could write about classical music in the way that I would have written about music for the New Musical Express in the 1970s, with a lot more sort of flamboyance and subjectivity and enthusiasm, and also not caring if I necessarily made a mistake. It felt sometimes breaking into classical music, you were penalized and punished if you made any kind of mistake and interrupted its formalities. And I wanted to just sort of break through some of this and definitely put all, you know, music together again in a way that it had been separated over time. The way that things are always put into alcoves and into genres and niches, and it seems to be separating music, you know, from each other. It stops making contact with each other. And I was interested to see if I could put a history of classical music back into a different sort of history.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting that you mentioned Brian Eno in the midst of that, and I think you may even say this at one point along in the book, maybe not specifically about Eno, but about others. If Brian Eno's ambient music, for example, was in the classical music section of a record shop.
Yes.
If a record shop
yes.
still existed, that is, it would be considered differently from what it is considered, I suppose, because of Eno's association with Roxy Music and all of the other, you know, pop and rock acts that he has been associated with.
Yes, you came to it because he was a glam rock pop star and you were prepared to try anything he did, and you didn't actually know, well, I didn't know at the time in my mid-teens what actual history of music it was attached to and where it had come from. It just, to me, was him making something that I was very excited about. And I think over the last, you know, now 40, even close to 50 years, I suppose what I've realized is that once you break into the history of classical music and see it as a series of revolutions and innovations by incredibly agile minds and understand what they were up to at the time they were doing it and break through some of the quaintness of the sounds, which, you know, you kind of get a little bit annoyed by if you're used to the sound of pop. If you break through all that, you suddenly start to hear it in a slightly different way. You hear it as a series of incredibly important sort of signals. You hear it more psychic energy, and you come to it less kind of intimidated by all the barriers that have been put up in its place.
What kind of barriers do you think are there?
Well, for me, I'm always talking about me. This is me making a music scene for one, I must say. But I just felt that coming from the outside, it was always very difficult for me to understand what I was beginning to listen to, because there were certain words that seemed initially alienating anyway. Even words like symphony and concerto and sonata, for a long time, I have to admit, were quite intimidating, because I thought, if I don't know what they are, I don't know how I can start listening to the music. Eventually, I must admit it took a long time, I begin to realize that it just means a collection of instruments. It just means a certain form. It just means that this is the context of the story of the piece of music is in. And I became less intimidated by what I felt were sort of a kind of language that was keeping me from something. So I guess what I had to do was work it out for myself and create my own history.
I've brought you back to 1973. Now I want to bring you back to 1999. You can probably guess what you're about to hear.
Imagine an actor saying the following.
Imagine me saying the following. When Debussy died on March the 25th, 1918 in Paris, it was being bombarded by the Germans, and it was raining.
And that's Il Pleur, the opening movement of Art of Noise and the Seduction of Claude Debussy. With me this evening on Arena, Paul Morley, speaking about his new book, A Sound Mind. And I bring that up, Paul, because obviously you were part of Art of Noise at one level. That's one part of it. But Debussy seems to have been a big love for a long time in terms of classical music.
I always felt that that period of French music at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, I certainly decided to take it as the beginning of all modern music. I felt that what certainly Debussy, Ravel and Eric Satie were doing at the time was a kind of preview of using the recording studio, even though the recording studio hadn't yet been invented. And they wrote music as if they were using the recording studio, which made it incredibly modern. They almost learned how to do overdubs, how to smear sound, how to make sound exist for its own sake. And so that Art of Noise album, The Seduction of Claude Debussy, was part of my attempt to sort of follow this research through. You know, I always like to do things that help me with my own education, like make a record, write a book, find out for myself. And certainly that was an attempt to sort of draw the map of 20th century music that begins with Debussy and leads to things like Miles Davis. It leads to ambient music and in many ways leads to all sorts of popular music in terms of the way that you can draw a line from from what he was doing to where we are now. And obviously I've extended, you know, those explorations into the book.
And you give us a playlist, you give us several playlists in the book, but one of them is from music of that period in and around the French composers, particularly Debussy and Ravel. But the poor old Bolero gets, I can't say that you ditched the Bolero, because you'll tell me you didn't ditch it as well. No. But in fact, it was probably safe to say Ravel had ditched it before you did.
Well, exactly. And I suppose it was another one of those pieces of classical music that tends to be, it tends to get in your way. It becomes a kind of kitsch obstacle, if you like. And another thing that, as I'm growing up, puts me off slightly because of the way it had been used as well, and sort of somehow diluted and corrupted by turning up in films and in it's sort of almost like a novelty piece of music.
And I suppose most people know it from the Torvald and Dean ice skating.
And Torvald and Dean, yes, that's right. And in fact, as a piece of music that's in itself about a piece of music, it's absolutely extraordinary. But I was interested again in going around the back of that, as was often the case with a lot of the composers in the book, and finding some of their less known pieces. One of the things I was also interested in when I wrote the book was how the canon has developed, and it's become very fixed. And there's a lot of fluid, beautiful pieces of music that have sort of fallen off the canon and don't get really talked about. And the canon gets more and more reduced and more rigid. And I guess part of my process was to sort of blow that wide open.
Part of what you argue in the book in that regard, Paul, is that the current way of consuming music, streaming, perhaps allows us to go in, to use your phrase, to go in the back of the better known pieces and find those other pieces.
Well, it was extraordinary for me as someone curious about music, because once upon a time it would have taken me a long time to get to all of Mozart, and then suddenly I could do it in a weekend. And that idea that also happens is that you were immediately led. I mean, it's obviously the algorithms have obviously replaced the critic, but I started to really love within classical music how it would lead me to other things very quickly. And it suddenly occurred to me that it seemed more modern to listen to Shostakovich on your phone than to listen to Cardi B. There was something extraordinary about hearing an immense piece of Shostakovich or Stravinsky just through my phone, whereas pop music is music made on machines that you were just then listening to on a machine and somehow seemed less miraculous. So this also excited me.
You mentioned there about the algorithms on the streaming platforms have removed the critic. In the book as well, you talk about, in fact, the democracy of the internet is another thing that has removed or has certainly changed the job of the music critic. Is the music critic now obsolete?
I think it's been replaced by not only the algorithms, but also that everyone kind of became a reviewer and hands out stars, and they rate things out of 10. And for me, what was interesting about that is that it tends to remove the context of the music as well. All music chronologically has collapsed because of streaming, and then it also seemed that somehow the history of music was falling apart as well. And as a kind of historian, I was very interested in what was going to happen next after this particular period, obviously accelerated this year. The idea that because all music now exists in these streaming sites, it all starts to mulch up and almost become the one thing, which to some extent terrified me, the idea that the individual composer would be removed and Spotify would almost be the one act, as if everything on it was by Spotify.
You also find yourself, I think, in somewhere in your 50s, when it was probably specifically around the 2010 documentary that you made around classical music, where you attended the Royal Academy of Music, in fact, studying composition for a period of time. But you found yourself becoming a kind of a darling of the classical music world. You were the young guy being brought in at the age of 50 to talk about all these, to talk about, you know, whatever, to host certain interviews and to be part of different festivals and things like that. You tell a great story about a debate you had, and you were quite adamant about, quite strong with this person that you were debating with. Can you remember the moment when it was, what that moment was, and how it was revealed to you who it was you were debating with?
Well, debating about the relevance of opera, the long-standing kind of conversation, and it was a darkened room, and I was going into one of my many speculations with probably what I've been doing with you. And in this darkened room, somebody suddenly announced, why don't you just shut up? And I got into a bit of a heated argument with this man who seemed very passionate about opera being right and relevant and always would be, and just leave with my great hits and my great costumes. And then eventually, after about 10 minutes of this, the lights came on and he was rolled out, and he was probably in his early 90s, being rolled out by his wife in her early 90s, who was in a wheelchair. And basically, I'd have been shouting at abuse at a poor guy that was just basically having some pleasure in his life. But I guess I'm from a world where taking music as if it's a matter of life and death was kind of what set me off as a rock critic. So I kind of brought that into a room where for some people it's just a matter of pleasure.
Yeah, well, also maybe it was a matter of life and death to him, and he was prepared to fight his corner.
Yes, he was fighting back. There was no doubt. It was like the beginning of an opera.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, then you start the book with you're on an aeroplane and you're trying to choose, rather morbidly, it has to be said, the final piece of music that you might hear before you shed your mortal coil. Without giving away the end of the book, obviously, are you any closer to making that choice?
Well, unfortunately, the choice, because of streaming, is now many millions of times more than it would have been. Whereas once I might have had a few in mind, I'm now spending many of my days just trying to work it out, because there's so much. Basically, my research and development has led me to more and more and more pieces of music. I think I end the book with the playlist, really, and it's probably 300-400 pieces long. And what in there may be is the piece.
Yeah, or else you're going to have a very long funeral service to get back at people.
Or to listen to it all keeps me alive a little bit longer.
Exactly, and if you keep working out what it is you're going to play, then you mightn't have to get around to playing it for quite
exactly.
a while. Paul, lovely to have spoken with you this evening, and thanks for a very interesting book, 600 and something pages that I will certainly be dipping into time and time again over the coming weeks. That's Paul Morley speaking to us about A Sound Mind, which is published by Bloomsbury.